White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 323.
All fiction starts with language. What kind of language do you use? It starts with the language and then goes to the story and then goes to the people. So I said, I want the language to be very stripped down and bleak and no adverbs. And just, so I want it stark. All right, I'm going to call him. The name is going to be Stark, just to remind me what we're doing here. The Richard was for Richard Widmark. And, well, that was, you know, a hero of mine. So
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you, our great patrons at patreon.com. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week we are joined by Levi Stahl of the University of Chicago Press and the editor and putter-togetherer of Donald E. Westlake, The Getaway Car. Welcome aboard this show, Levi. It's great to finally have you on board.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's good to talk.
Well, we have some very mutual interests, and we've known each other on Twitter and thereabouts for quite a while, and you were gracious enough to send me an early copy of this book, and I loved it. But it's been a while since I read it, so we're just going to have a sort of a free-flowing conversation, because for those that haven't figured it out yet from the, I'm sure, the label on this show or whatever, Levi's book is basically Donald E. Westlake's nonfiction and stuff about him and by him. So before we get into that, though, let's talk a little bit about you. Kind of lay out for our listeners who you are and what you do and how it intersected with Donald E. Westlake.
Sure. So I have been for almost 19 years now working at the University of Chicago Press in the marketing department. And I've had a variety of roles there. My current one, which I've had for 7 or 8 years now, is promotions director, which is basically second in command in the marketing department. I, along with a couple colleagues, I split up the marketing department among us and each oversee about half of what we do as a large group. Mm-hmm. And what that generally means is working with a mix of scholarly and general interest nonfiction books. We publish everything from very, very scholarly works that are primarily aimed at a library audience and a few scholars, all the way up to things that are truly general interest and aimed at kind of any educated reader. Like, we did a biography of Thoreau this summer that made the Times Notable List, was one of the Wall Street Journal's best books of the year, and really was the kind of book that you could give as a gift to just about any serious reader. So it's a nice mix of things, and it's a good range of types of book and varieties of types of knowledge. And what I like about that is it means that day to day, I might be working on any number of different subjects and needing to know a little bit about any number of different fields of study or areas of current news interest. And so it helps to be a generalist and kind of a dilettante about academic stuff and about reading. It intersected with Parker in a kind of unusual way with the Westlake stuff. We don't really publish much fiction, but we have always had a little sideline in fiction as reprints. So picking up, starting in the 80s, we and some other university presses realized that a lot of good writing was going out of print, that the general interest trade houses out of New York were dropping a lot of books that were good fiction but weren't necessarily mega sellers, but that for university press, we could put it in print, keep it there, and do okay with it. Mm-hmm. And we've done some of that over the years successfully. With the Parker books, it was a little bit more of a departure because we didn't do crime fiction. And yet whenever I – what would this have been now? Almost, it would have been a decade ago. Mm-hmm. About a decade ago, I read my first Parker novel. I read it was Ask the Parrot, of all things.
Oh, gosh.
Picked it up. Yeah. So I was out I was out of the bookstore at 57th Street Books in Hyde Park at lunch right before Thanksgiving. On that day right before Thanksgiving, when if you work in an office, there's nobody there and there's nothing going on. Mm-hmm. And so I just wandered off at lunch to find a book to read on the drive home to my family for the holiday, and grabbed that one because I'd read some Westlake's other stuff and had heard about Parker. And I started reading it that afternoon before I left the office because, like I said, there was nothing going on that day. And I got in the car and said to my wife, "I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to drive until I'm done with this book because I can't stop." And so within a couple of weeks, I had read six or eight of them maybe and realized that most of them were out of print and thought that there was an opportunity here. And fortunately, it's the kind of organization where if you've been there a while like I had and you've got a reasonably good track record as somebody who pays attention to books, you can get a hearing for even something that's as far out in left field for us as reprinting a series of crime novels. But I was able to make a case with the help of my colleagues that, you know, these are important. If you care about American literature and American culture, these are important books, mm-hmm. and they should be available. And on top of that, there would be an audience and we could sell them. So,
well, let me pause you there then and catch sure. our listeners up with what you're referring to, because that's
excellent. Oh, sorry, yeah.
That's excellent stuff. But first of all, you started with the next to last book, which is hilarious.
Yes.
That's number like 23 or whatever of the series. So I just think that's kind of funny. But and it speaks well to the series and to Westlake / Richard Stark, his pseudonym, that you could start at the next to last book and be that absorbed into it, right? That you didn't go, "Oh, I have no idea what's going on or who these people are or anything. Oh, this is horrible." I mean, you were sucked in that much with the next to last book, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Now the other thing I really want to point out is, and then we'll get back to your timeline, is that it's so funny that in 2006, 2007, whenever, you were saying, "Gosh, it would be a good idea if these books were back in print," because back then I was pulling my hair out that it was so hard to get them. If you looked at my bookcase here behind me, and I have all of the Parker and related books, including we'll talk about the IDW graphic novels and everything. I have all that on one shelf with some of the Dortmunders and whatever else. If you look at it, they all look different because about the early 2000s, Mysterious Press was put them all out. I guess because they were the ones that were publishing the new ones, right? There were like several from back in the 60s, early 70s, and then he stopped for like 20 years. We can get the specifics in a minute. And then he came back in like 97 and did several more. And so they went back and republished the early ones. But apparently they printed like 10 copies of each one because they went out of the bookstore as quickly as they could come in. And if I missed them, I missed them. So I still had gaps and gaps and gaps. So when the University of Chicago Press put those books out, I wanted to fall down on the floor at Barnes & Noble and weep tears of joy. I was finally getting to read the entire series and the ancillary books like Alan Grofeld we can talk about, mm-hmm. all at the same time. So that's the momentous nature of what you were able to accomplish. And I didn't even realize until now that it was you that kind of got that ball rolling. Bless you, sir. Bless you. All right. You're even more awesome than I already thought, and it was pretty cool. All right. So you got them to listen and to put – and what was kind of their reaction to wanting to do these books? I can't even imagine.
I will say, as a credit to the organization, it really was – people were willing to listen right off the bat, and what they wanted to hear was – Are there people out there who we consider to be valid authorities who would vouch for these books? Mm. And some of that, just to back up a little, is because everything we publish, including a reprint like this, needs to go through the university board and be approved as a valuable work. Mm. And to put our name on it, it is a little different from a commercial press, not to denigrate commercial publishing at all, but they are designed for profit. That is what they're doing. Sure. If a book is profitable, obviously there are other considerations, but to some extent that can be the consideration. For us, we also have to be able to make a case for why it matters. And so part of that was things like me pointing out, well, okay, in the mid-80s, Luc Sant in the New York Review of Books wrote about what a great series this was. John Bamville is a fan, and people who have a little bit more literary cachet outside of the crime world, and whose names, if they're mentioned to people, the faculty members who make up our board, they would sit up and take notice. So that helped, being able to build that credibility. And then it was a matter of handing out copies of half a dozen of them to people on staff and saying, here, give this a try, see what you think. And them realizing that these were not slapdash. These were not quickly written, tossed off books. These were really well-constructed, thoughtful works. Calling them literature is probably not fair to them because that's not what they're aiming for, right. But they really are. They're serious works of American writing, and there's a quality to them that elevates them above disposable crime fiction, certainly, and above even a lot of the really good crime fiction that lasts, I think.
Yeah, it's what I always call, with a lot of things, deceptively complex. You know, it seems simple. You read one of these books and you think, oh, this is, anybody could do this. It's just a straightforward story. And then you start looking behind the scenes at all the gears and the wheels and all, you know, that go into it. And you think, my goodness, it's kind of like I always refer to, like a Jimmy Page guitar solo. It sounds simple on the surface. And then you start thinking about it and you go, good heavens, you know, so the virtuoso nature that's required to construct something like that is really impressive. And to make it seem so seamless and so simple is really remarkable. So you got the Parker books into print. Let's go ahead and mention Grofield too. How did you get that? Did you just say, well, that's just part of it too, and we got to get that in there too, or what?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we started out with three Parker novels and kind of just to see. Mm-hmm. I was confident they were going to have an audience, and I think so were a lot of my colleagues. But just still, we didn't sign up 24 at once. But we got those out there, and basically, by the time they hit shelves, it was clear that this was going to be successful. So we decided we would do as many of the others as we could get rights to. And for a while, that was something like the first 17 or 18. Mm. And when we got through those, we decided to go ahead and do the Grofields, because I don't think anyone, myself included, would argue that Grofields are quite as good as the Parker books, but they're a lot of fun and they are good, and they fit in. If you like Parker books, they're totally worth checking out because they are kin in every way that matters.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So we signed those up as well.
Right. Yeah.
And that was fun too, because it just, you know, we looked at whether it would make sense to try to do Westlake outside of this series, publish other books of his. But really, this is what seemed to make sense, was stay within the Parker world, get as many of those out in the world as we could, and just be satisfied with that. And so the Grofields fit into that pretty well.
Just remind me now, because I didn't get them since I already had them in hardcover, sure, or whatever. But did you get the set that starts with Comeback? Have you guys done them too, or just the original?
So this past summer, we got the last four books. So we now have all 24 Parker novels in our series.
There you go.
We had the last four took a little while, partly because the last one, Dirty Money, actually came out when we were already doing this. Like, it was, I want to say it came out a couple months before our first one showed up. So those last four were in print for a while from other publishers, and so it took us a long time for that to kind of work its way out and for us to be able to sign them up. But yeah, now we can get uniform editions of all of them.
Right. Yeah. That's really cool. I have the Up Through Butcher's Moon on my shelf. Let me ask you this. They look so good. What was the, who was responsible for those covers? I always just stare at those covers and I think it's another deceptively simple, complex thing where you've got a running motif of the black silhouette of the gun. And then there's usually like a couple of stock photo images, which maybe in another series would look kind of cheesy, but on this, it gives that kind of 60s, 70s vibe, you know, of just kind of like it was put together on a light table by a graphic artist in a pulp, you know, studio or something. But I mean that in the most positive possible way. What was the how did that come together is what I'm trying to say.
Most of the credit there goes to David Drummond, who's a freelance designer. And if you ever go out and just look up his name, you'll see his portfolio of book designs is really impressive and wide ranging. Mm. This was a great assignment for him and a good thought to go to him on the part of our design department. And we gave him some guidance. You know, we with something like that, usually what you'll do is you'll send a designer some comparable books. You say, you know, you want it to look kind of like this, or you want a reader who'd pick up this book here to be drawn to ours. It's been long enough now that I don't actually remember what our comparables we sent were, but they would have been some other crime novels, and we would have emphasized that we did want to get some sense of the period across, even though, of course, the period shifts over the course of 50 years. But and then there was a lot of tinkering internally. People would make suggestions. Oh, okay, the cut of this woman's dress on this silhouette doesn't quite look right for this, and can we try something else? But generally, once David got this concept down, then it was just a matter of working around the edges. And I think he really nailed it. And it's the fun thing for me is it feels like a design that's going to stay viable for years to come. It's not going to look strange or dated in a few years, which some designs do.
Right. The mysterious press editions all just had a black cover, basically, which was designed to look like a matchbook.
And it's a clever idea.
Yeah.
But I feel like they haven't held up that well.
Right. I look at it on my shelf, and next to the bright with the black down the middle of the Chicago press versions, they definitely jump out much better. Using a different color for each one, which is kind of similar to what I had. Another big long series that I own on a different shelf are the Patrick O'Brien Master and Commander books, and they did a similar thing where they have a different color spine for every book, and they look uniform, but they look individual at the same time. And that's a tricky thing to pull off, so it works pretty well.
Yeah, and I'm not a designer myself by any means, but I know that one thing that helps a designer is knowing in advance that they're doing a series, not having to realize that and adjust to it as you go along, but knowing that, like with the paperbacks of the O'Briens or with these, that you're going to be doing X number of books.
Right.
And part of the idea is it should look good on a shelf.
So while we're talking about the Parker books, I'm sure you've read the Darwin Cook IDW graphic novel adaptations.
Yeah, and I remember my wife and I were big fans of Darwin Cook going back to his New Frontier series with DC that we just were both gone on that. Mm-hmm. So when IDW announced that he was going to be doing this, we basically just jumped up and down because they – the idea of this person who was so good at capturing that mid-century look,
right,
turning himself over to the Parker novels was just spectacular. And I love them. I think it works so well. What I didn't expect was how, and I should have, I guess, given his previous work, but was how creative he got with the way to tell the stories.
Right.
How he would break form and suddenly he's working in a lot of prose with some images, and then suddenly he's changing up his whole structure of how he's doing his panels. Nothing stayed the same. He really adapted it so much to suit different parts of the story and the different goals of each section. And that was impressive.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I just, you know, just a few months ago, I finished adapting a novella of mine into three comic book scripts. And I, you know, really learned firsthand just how challenging it can be to change from one medium to another with a story, because, you know, you're confronted with totally different ways of pacing things. I mean, pacing, I think, is the main thing. With a graphic novel like that, you have to make every page hit and hit a certain set of notes and come to almost a little ending on each. You know, it'd be unnatural to kind of leave things hanging in the middle of a beat. You know, you need to kind of have beat through the page by page. And so he really was creative in where some pages don't have a lot going on and some are just almost dense with text, but it never loses that momentum is the thing that's remarkable, you know. So I think he did an amazing job. His art, like you say, it definitely fits that period as well. And those things are really just, I wish he'd lived regardless, but I wish he could have done more, you know?
Yeah. No. On a personal note, when I was putting together the getaway car, my one request to our design department, and I told them, I will understand if we can't do this, but I would love for you to see if Darwin Cook would do the cover. And he jumped at it. He said what we were looking for was a cover illustration, and he said he would happily do it if he could do the whole cover, the whole of the design, and he did it for us, and at a rate that reflected his appreciation of Westlake, I should say. Like, he was great on this, and he turned in an amazing cover. So I will always be grateful that the book I worked on got to have Darwin Cook's hands involved.
That is awesome. So, I mean, is it the one I'm looking at now? Then is the car pointing at you?
Yeah.
Okay,
So that's a Darwin Cook illustration, and everything about the typeface, everything on it was him. He put it together.
So, that's amazing. Am I missing where it says that?
It should say on the back. Yeah, down on the back near the barcode.
Oh, there it is. Okay, I was looking on the title page. Okay.
Yeah, my colleague Cook. Isaac Tobin did the interior design, and then Darwin Cook did everything on the cover, on front and back.
Well, dang. I'm insanely jealous and appreciative. That's just crazy. That's amazing. Yeah, you definitely hit a home run in every possible way with this book. Well, let's talk about this book a little bit. We got other things to talk about too, but you know, you were able to go out. I mean, how did this book first? It started with reprinting the Parker books, and then you got the idea to do this book, and you had to.
Basically, it just really grew out of the Parker books. As we were going out with them, since I'm in marketing, I'm in publicity, and just the nature of my job means when people in media, or in books, if they're thinking of the University of Chicago Press, I'm one of the people that they tend to know because I'm just out there as a public face for us in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And certainly when it came to the Parker books, I played that role. You know, I was out there praising them to everybody I could find and just talking to people about how good they were and how they were the kind of books I liked as a reader, not just as a publicist. And the course of all that, I got to meet a bunch of people, including got to talk to Abby Westlake, Westlake's widow, and got to talk to Lawrence Block, one of his old friends, and then also a bunch of Parker fans, including Trent Reynolds, who runs the Violent World of Parker site.
Oh yeah,
where he had a fair number, 3 or 4 essays by Westlake, different lengths, different subjects. But the one that really caught my eye was something he had delivered as a talk at the Smithsonian in, I think, 83 on the hard-boiled detective and his history.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that and I thought, wow, this is actually somebody who's thought a lot about this genre and about the area in which he makes his living. He's thought about as a craftsman and as a reader. To say he's thought about as a scholar is probably a stretch, but there were hints of that. This was someone who was making a case and bringing in the evidence for it and building together an argument about what the hard-boiled private eye is. And I thought, I wonder if he's done more. And I started looking around and I found 3 or 4 other things and decided it was worth putting together a proposal for my colleagues to see if I could actually assemble a book. And I'll admit, at first I thought there might just be enough material to do an ebook, or we might have to pad it out with articles about Westlake from other people or something like that. But once I started looking, started doing library research, I was really astonished at how much he had written over the years. It was a mix of things. There was a lot of stuff I didn't use that I liked, but wasn't so revelatory. Things like he did a fair amount of book reviewing for the New York Times Book Review throughout the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And all of his book reviews are interesting because I'm interested in what he thinks about these books. Not all of them were the sort of thing that we'd include in a collection like this. But I realized I just had enough material I could work with. And then Abby Westlake offered to let me go to their house and go through his files.
Wow.
And it was spectacular. I'm still so grateful to her for that. She invited me, and then I took Ethan Iverson, the jazz pianist and Westlake expert, who Abby had met years ago with Don, and then Ethan's wife, Sarah. We went up for basically a country house weekend at their farmhouse in the country, and Ethan and I sat for 2 days straight and just went through the files, which, if you're a fan of a writer, to get to sit down and go through all their working files, it was a candy store for me and Ethan. We had such a good time. We kept pulling stuff out and being like, whoa, wait, take a look at this. And but we were also like, I had a sense of the kind of things I was looking for, unpublished material, letters, shorter like typescripts of essays that may not have ever ended up going anywhere. And over the course of 2 days, I assembled a big pile of documents, and that's where I got like all the material in this section of letters, which really was one of my most fun parts of the book for me, because it's just his correspondence with friends and business associates, and almost every single one of them has a really funny line or two in it. And so I gathered all that material together, the stuff that had been published, the stuff that had been unpublished, and just started making what seemed like would be a good book for me as a reader. That was ultimately how I judged everything, was if I were a Westlake fan and didn't have access to all this, which parts of it would I want to see? And I knew from working in books for so long, I knew roughly how long a book I wanted to do. I had a sense of how you might organize this material. So I had some advantages that somebody coming cold to this business wouldn't. But a lot of it was just the material itself really worked. I remember there was a moment when I was sitting in my house with a stack of TypeScript in front of me, and I realized this is actually a really good book. I knew that I could put together a book that would be interesting and that would sell, but the fact that it also just, I think, genuinely ended up being very good. I don't feel like there's stuff in there that was filler or that can't stand on its own well. And then also that it ended up, again, unexpectedly, I realized it's a book about writing. I don't know what I thought I was going to be putting together before that, but really that's what comes through again and again. There's other stuff in there. There's a great essay about being trapped on an island in the Pacific on his way back from military service and listening to what's that Peter Sellers radio show from the UK, listening to this comedy radio program and realizing, oh my God, this is what comedy is for, is to save you when nothing else will. But for the most part, it's a book about what it's like to be a writer, what the work of a writer is, how books work and how they come together. And I just ended up being absolutely fascinated by all that material. And I think the reaction seems to be that Westlake fans have been as well.
Was he still alive when the University of Chicago started printing this series?
He was. We published our first ones in July of 2008, and he died on New Year's Eve
of that year.
And so I never got to meet him. We corresponded a tiny bit, and I know that he was really – he was excited that the not just that the books were available again, but that they served as the occasion for a lot of people that summer to write articles saying, hey, this guy is great. You should check him out.
That's awesome.
Here's a great place to start. So it was fun to be able – I mean, not obviously not knowing what was coming, but to be able to give a writer that late in his career a moment where everybody stops and – offers real appreciation.
Absolutely. I love the section headings that you put in. I'm assuming that you're responsible for these, right?
Oh, good.
How you structured the contents to be basically like a crime, like a caper, you know, like a heist, and then various things around that, like anything you say may be used against you, or side jobs, signed confessions, jobs never pulled, the other guys in the string. Most wanted. I mean, that's great. How did you come up with the idea of structuring it that way?
That was just a flash idea one day as I had the structure together, and then I realized I was going to have to name the sections, and I think it was signed confessions came first. That's the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, oh, okay, maybe I can make everything work in this way. I will admit I was nervous about it because you should adding something that's even slightly comic to a book by a comic writer. It feels risky,
yeah.
But I like to think I didn't go too far and it came off okay.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, cause it's not, I mean, it doesn't go beyond just saying, you know, here are the unifying themes of each of these chapters and all. And that's great. So I thought it was very good. I liked it. So, what has been the reception of your book to your book, and what have you heard about it from anybody? And are people digging it as much as I have?
It's been really fun. It got reviewed widely, which for somebody in my position is a ton of fun because, for example, I went out. So one of the things I do for my job is I meet with book review media. So I go and call on the editor of the Times Book Review and the books people at the Wall Street Journal and other places. And there is no feeling quite like handing the editor of the Times Book Review a galley and saying, oh, yeah, this one's mine. And then the next time you're there, being able to say, hey, thank you for that. You guys gave it a great review. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not because you know me. That's not, you know, they're careful about that kind of thing. But I still appreciate it and was happy to get a chance to say thank you, which most authors don't get to do in that form exactly. Right. But yeah, so it got reviewed in the Times and the Wall Street Journal. It was, pardon me. And the reception was really, really good and really satisfying. People used it as an occasion to tip off readers to Westlake's career in general. And they received the book in the way I had hoped, which is here's some stuff from somebody whose voice you thought was silent. You thought you'd gotten all the Westlake you're going to get. Here's some other stuff that was hiding in plain sight. So you get to spend some time with this guy's voice again. Mm-hmm. And then also as a bit of insight into the books you already know and love, and as a reminder to go back to them. And that was kind of how everybody from Michael Dearda in the Post to Bill Kristol in the Wall Street Journal approached it. And that was really gratifying because that was what I had been hoping for from it. It sold well enough we had to reprint, and it continues to sell slowly but steadily. So I can't ask for much more.
Right. No. And it works on several different levels. I was just thinking as you were saying that. I mean, it's in some ways it's like a partial biography. It's a it's a repository of stuff you wouldn't have found of his, certainly not in one place anywhere else. It's a kind of a retrospective, and like you said, it's kind of a book on writing, and it's sort of a celebration of a great literary figure. It's got a lot going on all at the same time, which is pretty awesome. I mean, that's not a lot of books can say they have that many different, you know, things that can appeal.
Well, the autobiography is a great example of what I kind of fortuitous things that I got was able to do with this book, which is it when I got to Westlake's files, one thing Abby, his wife, his widow, mentioned was that he had back in, I want to say, the late 90s, written a draft of an autobiography, and he decided ultimately that I don't remember her exact words, but something like basically it wasn't quite, he didn't think it was quite good enough to publish. It wasn't quite interesting enough. And while on the one hand, I would still happily see the whole thing published, on the other hand, having read it, I see what he means, because he was a writer and what he did with his day was write. He didn't have a particularly dramatic life. You'll read writers' biographies like that sometimes, and that's because what they are doing is working. That said, there was enough interesting stuff about his early years that I was able to take something like 25 pages of that and start off the book with it and give that material a home and give it readers who it wouldn't have had and bring readers something that they didn't expect and really enjoyed. That was a really fun, fortuitous set of circumstances that exemplifies, I think, what I was hoping to do with the book.
But I like, too, that you said in the introduction that you included a few things just because they were funny. And I mean, that's one thing that I started to say it's not appreciated. I think it is. I think that people appreciate that Westlake, in his various literary incarnations, he could write very hard-boiled, very rough, violent stuff. But he always, you know, even in the Parker books, which are so dry and sparse, like a desert, he would include things that were funny. You found stuff that he had done that was funny that people hadn't really seen, right?
Yeah. I think my favorite of those, I think, I'm going to go ahead and spoil the joke because it's fun. There was a page-long contribution to an anthology and the anthology was edited along a certain theme, and I will wait to tell the theme till after, but he goes through, he's doing a recipe for sloth and for cooking sloth. And he's saying, he goes through this fairly long, like full page of details of how you go about dealing with the sloth and how you prepare it to cook. It's sloth a la Dortmunder. And he's describing the way you saute it briefly over a hot flame with shallots, carrot circles, and just a touch of Tabasco. Prepared in this fashion, sloth is an excellent main course, not unlike alligator in texture and taste. And then he goes on to the whole point of this page-long piece. Many people are under the false impression that sloth does not make a good meal, but this is because they've eaten it improperly prepared. It can only be sautéed a la Dortmunder, a fact ill-appreciated in culinary circles. Too many cooks broil the sloth. The whole point, and the whole point of the anthology was this kind of transposition. It's ridiculous. It's as dumb as you can possibly get, and it made me laugh out loud when I first found it.
Wow.
So there's a handful of pieces like that that are just goofy humor, a lot of it involving wordplay of one kind or another, with no point to it beyond fun. Well, and it's something you can, when you're doing a book like this, it's relatively easy to throw in a page here and a page there of that kind of material that otherwise would be completely lost.
Right. Yeah, because there's no other possible venue that you would that could be used in. I mean,
yeah.
Once it's no longer a relevant, you know, article or whatever for whatever he was doing at the time, then yeah. So that's really good. Yeah. So there's another thing. Your book is kind of a time capsule that saved a few things that otherwise wouldn't have seen the light of day again. So. Well, that's awesome. So the that book, by the way, let's just make sure people know what it is. It's called The Getaway Car, and Levi is the editor of Record, and it's Donald Westlake's nonfiction and various miscellanea all put together and expertly sewn up with a Darwin Cook cover, and it's from the University of Chicago Press as well. So I recommend you check that out. Now, the other publisher that has been doing some Westlake recently, because it, you know, the Mysterious Press for a while, they haven't really, not that I've seen, done anything lately, is Hard Case Crime. And they.
Yeah, they're the folks that first introduced me to Westlake.
Okay.
I think I read 361.
Yes.
From them back in like 2006 or so. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got that one right over here behind me. That's a good one, too. They have been a godsend as well, because they've brought a lot. I mean, they've done some new stuff, but they've also brought back a lot of stuff. They don't publish a ton of books, though. So this is what I was going to ask you. I could see them doing like The Hunter. I can't see them doing the entire series, which is why I'm so glad that you guys did. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah. Charles Ardai, one of their co-founders and their editor, is a friend, and he was someone who was very helpful to me when I first started looking into doing this series and in doing The Getaway Car. And he actually served as one of the readers for The Getaway Car for our internal process of vetting a book. Excellent. We'll have external readers, and he and Sarah Wyman were both kind enough to do that work for me for this book. And it was invaluable to get their commentary on what worked and what didn't, and get Charles correcting mistakes and things.
Mm-hmm.
But so he and I talked about this, about Westlake and the Parker books, fairly early on. And one thing I wanted to check with him actually was, you guys aren't planning to do this, right? And he said, I'm going to just paraphrase, and I may be getting it slightly wrong here, but basically no, because he wouldn't want to just do a couple. He couldn't commit his whole publishing line to publishing all of them.
Right.
But he didn't want to foreclose that opportunity for somebody else. For Don's sake.
That's awesome.
And that left it open for us. So that was why they do publish one of the Grofield novels, Lemons Never Lie.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like they could do that because those were just slightly different, and he wouldn't feel like he was taking an opportunity away from Don for the long run.
Right. That's the one I was going to ask you about. And I've communicated with you previously about that, which is that I have the Hard Case Crime version of Lemons Never Lie, and I've got the other three Grofields from Chicago. And the only complaint I have is they're completely different format of books.
It's
it spoils the line on my shelf.
No, I know.
But other than that, I, you know, and who could blame him for wanting to hang on to it?
That's the thing. So long as I am such a fan of Hard Case Crime that even if there were a way for us to suddenly get it from them, I wouldn't want to do it. So long as they want to keep it in print, we'll happily sell the ebook as part of our series and let them sell this one.
Oh, that's right. You have it in ebook.
Yeah, because they at that point at least, and I think probably still to some extent, you know, Charles Ardai's whole point with this, with founding Hard Case Crime, was he liked the feel of those pulp paperbacks. Mm-hmm. He wanted to bring back these pulp paperbacks, and so ebooks, in some sense, when they came along, were kind of a necessary evil for him. I may be exaggerating his point of view, but they weren't the thing that was driving him.
Right. You
know? So when we said we were going to do ebooks of all the other Grofields, it wasn't a big issue for him to go ahead and for us to sign up those rights.
Okay. Yeah, that was it. That's how because you and I had talked before. I found that one on Amazon, and it had the cover dress of the others, and I was like, "Whoa!"
Yes.
But then it wasn't in paperback. Okay, so
yeah, so we did it. We did a cover just like for the others, but only a digital version, basically.
Yeah, the Grofield, we didn't talk about that. Let's talk about Parker and Grofield. And the other question I had for you, too, was you mentioned Dortmunder. For those that don't know, and I'm sure that if you're listening to this show, you probably have an idea, but Dortmunder is what had happened was he was trying to write a Parker book, and it kept turning funny, and he thought, well, Parker's not supposed to be funny. I mean, I'm kind of abbreviating this, but so he created a whole new character and cast around him for basically Parker-style books that are funny. Or kind of funny. They're sort of tragic funny, I guess is the word.
Yeah. The way I always describe it to people mm-hmm. is in a Parker book, everything goes wrong and people die. And in a Dortmunder book, everything goes wrong and it's funny.
Yeah.
And to a large extent, that really is how they work.
Yeah. That's true. So I guess the rights to the Dortmunder books are a completely separate thing. And is there any thought about going after those at some point or what?
I would love to do that. I think it's probably unlikely because of a number of them are in print in various formats, and the first one, the Hot Rock, has been in print pretty continuously. Hmm. Another issue that's developed since we did the Parkers, we kind of got lucky with our timing doing this in 2007, 2008, which is since then companies have snapped up ebook rights to a lot of books just to do ebooks.
Right.
And and if you're a rights holder, it's not a bad thing to go ahead and just get one out there if you aren't sure you're going to see a print edition or a print and ebook edition from a publisher. And I suspect that's I haven't looked for a while, but I suspect that's the case with some of the Dortmunders that may not be in print in paperback. And with crime fiction, it's tough to do it as print books alone. The market is about 50% ebook these days.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to do it, but I think it's unlikely. That said, I would love for somebody to do good editions of those, because I'm sure, like yours, my collection is a real mess.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I've got a couple of hardcovers and then paperbacks and just all and different publishers. And it's just, he is definitely an author that has jumped around different publishing companies a lot over the years. You know, you end up with just a real patchwork quilt of books.
Yeah. And it was interesting going through his files to see some of the traces of how that happened. Because there, of course, be correspondence with agents and with publishers. And part of it is just a 50-year career and all the change that involves naturally. Everything from, you know, starting out with pulp publishing to by the end you're doing hardcovers of your books to start. And then reissues and conglomeration. And there's just so much change in the industry itself if you work that long. But then also some of it did seem to be tied to working with specific editors or working with or against expectations from publishers. He wrote about in an essay that's in the book, in The Getaway. Sorry, my dog is on dog duty now. In an essay that's in The Getaway Card, he wrote about writing the novel The Axe, which is from 97, is a terrifying novel about a guy, a middle manager at a printing plant who's in his, I want to say his late 40s, early 50s, loses his job and is having a hard time finding a new one, and finally decides that his only hope is to kill the competition. He puts out an ad asking for basically his skill set and kills the five people who respond.
Oh, wow. And I was going to say, your dog is a big fan of that book, apparently.
Yeah, he's a huge fan. So I remember I read that one right around the time of the financial crash. And I remember thinking, oh God, this book, because it brings home all that claustrophobia and despair of,
right,
will I ever work again?
Oh, man.
And it's a terrifying book. But so he wrote that, and it got a claim of a sort that he hadn't seen, a claim closer to what a literary novelist gets.
Mm-hmm.
And partly it did. It felt like it had – it feels like a little different kind of book from him, like slightly different ambitions, but it's still a crime novel. And he wrote about how after that he turned in a book, just a kind of ordinary Donald Westlake book. I want to say it was I don't remember now, but it was a comic crime novel, not a series book. And his publisher was like, yeah, you can't follow the axe with that. You need to move up and beyond.
Wow.
And his letter to his agent or about it and about how he basically was just like, look, I'm going to write the books I'm going to write.
Right.
That's why I chose this profession. So there was definitely some struggle there too over the years that led to some changes of publisher and agent, because he was committed to, you know, each thing I do might be different, mm-hmm, and I'm going to try to find my audience each time, but you're going to have to go along with me.
Yeah, because he could write so many different things. And then, I mean, he used different pseudonyms partially to kind of do different things. I mean, I know that, you know, if you go way back when there were more, you know, magazines printing stories and all that in the pulp era and all that, they would use different pseudonyms to have multiple stories in the same issues or whatever, but or not to seem like one writer was kind of dominating a magazine. Mm-hmm. But he did it as well because he would do so many different, you know, like he, you know, Richard Stark is pretty much the name he used just for Parker and Grofield, I guess.
Yeah, and then there were a number of others over the years who would do short series. He did under the name Tucker Coe, he did five books about a former New York cop. He did the Samuel Holt series, which was basically about a former TV star who starred in a show kind of like, Starsky and Hutch or something, who ended up solving crimes. So he would do these kind of discrete projects under different identities. And there's actually an essay in The Getaway Car where his different identities have a roundtable interview among themselves.
Yeah.
And it's a ton of fun seeing how he characterizes each one and how they interact, because each one is a truly distinct approach to writing, mm-hmm, even though when you line them all up together, you can still recognize, oh yeah, that's a Westlake book.
Right. Well, another book that he did, and I wanted to ask if you've read this and what you thought about it. I reviewed it a few months ago on the show, I think on video, was the one that was supposed to be a James Bond screenplay. Forever and a Death.
Forever and a Death.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, that Hard Case Crime published this summer.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked it. To be honest, it's a little too long. I think if he had ended up publishing it, I suspect he would have trimmed it some.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But I really enjoyed seeing him turn his hand to a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It's just it's a slightly different genre from crime fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with a little more set piece action, a little more creativity on a large scale. You know, the creativity isn't so much necessarily about plot mechanics as it is about big things. What kind of plot can we come up with that's big enough to power a James Bond film, basically?
Right.
And seeing him think on that scale is fun. And then to think about how, so it didn't end up being made as a James Bond film for a variety of reasons that are explained in, I think, really interesting way in the afterword by the Bond producer who first tried to sign him up.
Right.
To think about how it might have worked as a Bond film and what a different feel it might have had. I don't know. I ended up really enjoying it more than I expected necessarily, because I'm not a huge Bond person. I like Bond fine, but there are fans. And so I enjoyed it a lot. And like anything though, too, just getting to hear the voice of a favorite writer again when you don't necessarily expect to is such a pleasure.
You know, yeah, I am a huge Bond fan. I actually have a show, a whole separate show just
for
Bond.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't want to make that claim for you, but I knew I was speaking to one.
Well, that's right. And I think Alan J. Porter and I are going to do a show about it as soon as he reads it. He hasn't quite gotten to it yet. And he's certainly even bigger of a expert by far than me. But the thing I thought was interesting about it is that it's very much, I mean, if you look at it as a Bond story, it's very much like one of the earlier Bond stories in the case of like a rich megalomaniacal villain. You know, they don't really do those stories anymore. It's the Brosnan era was kind of the last of those. We're not really in that world anymore of Bond facing the supervillain that wants to blow up a city or something. So that was interesting in a way. The other thing, though, that I was curious about from your perspective as far as how he did it is that it clearly was written to have, you know, on the cover it says, like, only one man can save, you know, everybody, which sounds very Bond, but when you read it, it's not at all about one man. There's like a bunch of people that each do a little bit. There's no one man that's a hero in it.
Yeah, and it does. I had that same thought. It does make you wonder what the difference would have between the book he turned it into and the screenplay it would have been are, because it does. He turned it into much more of an ensemble piece.
Yes.
Almost, even though it's not a heist novel, almost like a heist where you need all these different people doing their thing. Mm-hmm. In this case, they weren't necessarily all doing their thing in a coordinated fashion, but they all had their roles to play in how the plot comes together and is unraveled. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting too, because you can see the traces of Bond there, but you don't have the superhero in the center.
There's no Bond.
Yeah.
There's Bond villain.
There's not that person who ultimately cuts through everything and saves the day.
Right. There's a Bond girl, there's a Bond villain, there's a Bond situation, but there's no Bond. So
yeah,
I would like to go back and read the original script. I wonder if that's even possible.
I am trying to remember. I don't think I saw it in his files, but of course that's been several years ago, and I saw a bunch of stuff. And I can't remember whether that's discussed in the afterword by the producer or not, what stage it actually got to, or what finally ended up happening with the script itself. But it must have been a very different animal with similar plot bones.
Well, I hadn't thought about it till you said that just now about looking at his files, but if you ever come across it, you know who to call.
Yes.
We'll talk.
I had a great moment this spring, actually along those lines, talking about that book. Abby Westlake told me that when he was first working on this book, on the plot idea for the Bond film, he was like, I need to know how to destroy Hong Kong. So he called English architect Norman Foster, a world famous architect, and just called him and said, so if you had to destroy Hong Kong, how would you do it? And Norman Foster gave him some ideas.
Wow.
I just love the idea that you get a call from Donald Westlake, and this is, of course, the kind of thing he's going to ask.
Right. That's awesome. Yeah. If it had been anybody else, you might call the FBI or something.
Yeah.
But if it's Westlake, you're like, oh, okay, he's writing something. The last thing I had for you, and then if there's anything you want to mention that we haven't, is we talked about the books and everything, but we haven't talked about the characters that much. And I've got friends that are bigger Parker fans, friends that are bigger Dortmunder fans, even a couple of Grofield. Who do you prefer out of those three?
I am ultimately a bigger Parker fan than anything else, although I do really like all three. Mm-hmm. For me, the draw of Parker continues to be what it was from the start, which is watching a very skilled professional go about his work.
Yes.
And you know, the fact that these are ultimately books about doing a job and doing it well, as someone who cares about those things in my everyday life and, you know, tries to do that myself, I really appreciate seeing this level of attention to the fundamentals of craft. Now, that craft is stealing. But
I sat down and wrote a book about a guy who walks into New York across the George Washington Bridge, creates his own ID, and just claws a little space for himself in the city. So I can look back at it and say, that's what I was doing. I was doing autobiography. I was doing, you didn't invite me to the party, but I'm not leaving. If I'd known that's what I was doing, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But I could look back and say, that's where that's from. I still believe then that at the end of a story, the good guy is supposed to win and the bad guy is supposed to lose. So at the end of the thing, I had Parker caught arrested by the police. And my agent sent it to Gold Medal, which was the best outfit then, and they said no, they sent it back. So they sent it to Pocketbooks. And at that time, there was an editor at Pocketbooks, so I didn't yet know, with the wonderful name of Buckland Moon. And he called me and he said, I like this book. And I like this character. Is there any way that the character could get away at the end and you give me 3 books a year about him? And I said, I think so. And I did for 2 years. I did 3 books a year for 2 years. And then it sort of tapered off. But there was something so liberating. And so after that, I said, well, I did not put any reader-friendly stuff with this guy. You know, he doesn't have any warm, soft parts. He doesn't have a puppy. You know, there's no redeeming social quality in this guy at all. But that's what Buck seemed to like. If I'd known I was going to write book after book about him, there's two things I would have done differently about his name. I would have given him a first name, which I never did, and eventually became too late. And I probably wouldn't have called him Parker, because I've had almost 30 books of trying to figure out other ways to say Parker parked the car.
But it is ultimately about a person trying to do a great job. And then also, the Parkers, I think, are more insightful about people. I say this again, I love the Dortmunders and I love the Grofields, but the Parker books are the ones where you get a lot of actual insight into how people think and work and feel. And a lot of that comes from Parker himself with his weird sociopathic distance, yet still, in some ways, because he doesn't feel these things the same way, he's had to learn how they work for people, and he'll lay them out and make use of them. So things as simple as his habit of calling people by their names when he's got them held hostage, because they feel more secure and they're less likely to suddenly freak out if somebody's addressing them by name. Or there's a great scene in Breakout where he has managed to break out of this prison in the middle of like Nebraska or somewhere, and he's captured a state policeman in his own car. And the conversation they have is really remarkable because it's laced through with this knowledge about what masculinity entails and how far and in what ways Parker can and what ways he shouldn't try to push this man in order to get away with the least risk to himself. Mm-hmm. And that involves also doing the least damage to this man's sense of himself as a strong man. It's a fascinating exchange, and it's the kind of thing that Parker novels throw up again and again, because so much of Parker's day is, how do I get out of this alive, and preferably with as many of the people in the room alive as I can as well.
That's really a good point. There's because the two things that I'm going to follow up on that. One is that I think that Parker is such a blank slate. I always, to my wife or whoever, when I try to explain what's so appealing, I say, well, he's like a robot. I mean, he really is like an android. But he's such a blank slate that he makes the normal characters that enter and exit the story around him all the more vivid, and they really stand out. I mean, the characters that the supporting characters and guest characters in his stories, they stand out in your mind like bright, you know, four color cartoon characters, not because they are necessarily that weird and wacky, but just because any normal person next to Parker looks like a vivid cartoon character.
Yeah, very much.
In anything they do. You or I next to Parker look like Bugs Bunny, you know.
Yeah. And then there's also, I think, early on, Westlake hit on a really brilliant way to structure the books that he didn't deviate from, which is you start with a section that's essentially from Parker's point of view, although it's still told in third person.
Right.
And then you shift to a section in the middle of the book that's told from the point of view of other characters in the story. So you get all these different perspectives, and in some ways that just gives you breathing space, because spending that much time with that close in Parker's mind is hard.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but that's an excellent point.
But it also really gives you a sense of what these other people are like, and again, what's motivating them, because that so much of this comes down to manipulating different motivations and how Parker's good at it. But on the idea of Parker being kind of robotic, it just calls to mind one of my favorite moments in the whole series, which is the very end of the last book, Dirty Money, mm-hmm. where Parker and his couple associates who've just finally pulled this job that has taken forever
yeah.
and has been a disaster, they leave a guy, another criminal, tied up in the back room of a bar where when the people who own the bar show up in the morning, they're going to kill him. That's just guaranteed to happen. And the guy is like, wait, you're leaving me here. You can't do this. They'll kill me in the morning. And Parker says, well, you've got tonight. And on the one hand, it's totally a flip line. On the other, it's also a whole ethos. Because right. if you're Parker, so long as you still have tonight and you're still breathing, yeah. just keep fighting. You just keep at it, and you might be free by morning, and you might be fine. All you need is time and life, and you'll keep at it.
Parker would be. He'd be free
by
exactly. the
next
morning.
So he figures... not his fault. It's not his fault if you're not capable enough to escape.
And
He's
giving you a shot. Here's the good thing about it is everything he does is so calculated, from things like that down to just, like you say, the way he interacts with normal people. I mean, I love how if he has a conversation with a waitress in a restaurant, anybody else would just be making small talk to pass the time or just, hey, how you doing, whatever. Everything Parker says, even to a waitress, is carefully calculated to keep her from thinking he's strange and calling the police or something.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre, but it's amazing.
And then you combine that too with the fact that he's so good at what he does, but Westlake manages also to keep him from ever seeming a superhuman or there's not a sense that, oh, this guy can do anything. Mm-hmm. He's a superhero. It really is more just, nope, he's going to outwork you and outplan you and have more willpower than you do. And those are not super qualities. They're just human qualities really pushed.
It's really remarkable. I mean, yeah, exactly. And just, I love how he has no other life really. Well, I mean, that kind of varies, because in the early books, I think Westlake still hadn't quite settled on exactly what he was outside of his crimes. And so he talks about he owned a parking lot or something for tax purposes. And he had a wife in the first book, Lynn, before she betrayed him and she died. And, but later on, as you go along, he has a very separate life, part of it with Claire in their, in their little house on the lake or wherever they go to resorts and stuff. And then he has his life with his gang, with his different guys he gets together to do jobs, to do crime. And otherwise, he's just like going into a hotel room and lying on the bed staring at the ceiling until it's time to go do something.
Yeah, it is a really strange existence. And it's amazing that you still end up buying this character.
Yes.
Despite this.
Despite it.
You're like, oh, okay, no, this actually all tracks with how I understand this character.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like a robot. Like anybody else would go hang out at the bar or go back to their room and at least watch TV. He just lies on the bed in the dark staring at the ceiling until it's time to go do something. It's like he's going back to his recharging port.
Yeah.
Like he's a robot,
It really does.
Oh, man. One other thing I thought of, and I don't want to keep you forever, but one other thing I've got to ask you about, because I'd totally forgotten to mention this, is that he has made the transition in some ways to other media. And we've had movies over the years, and we even have a character on television for a while on Leverage, the blonde lady Parker was based on Parker. What do you think about the ways he's been portrayed by actors in various things? What's the best one, and what do you think about him in general?
Oh, I can have fun with this, because I actually, so this spring I got to co-curate a Westlake Film Festival at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens.
Oh, excellent.
And it was so much fun. It just started out with, like all this stuff seems to start out, it started out with just talking with a friend about, hey, Westlake did a lot of movies, but the friend is a curator at the Museum of the Moving Image. And so within a couple of weeks, we're like, yeah, I think we can do this program. So we showed 7 movies over the course of 2.5 days, and we had a panel with Abby Westlake and Larry Block and Luke Sant and I talking about Westlake and his movies. The only Parker one we showed was Point Blank.
Okay.
And so you've got the extremes, right? I think you go from, you've got Lee Marvin mm-hmm. as Parker in Point Blank, where the fundamental problem of putting Parker on screen is that he doesn't talk and he doesn't show emotion.
Right.
And he's ruthless. So you've got a couple of choices, I think, for how you can change him up. You could do like Lee Marvin did and basically just turn him into this incredible physical presence that is otherwise, for the most part, kind of a monster, mm-hmm. and just chew your way through every scene. And he's amazing at that. Or you can do like they did with the Jason Statham film and just soften him some.
Right.
So that one's from 2013 or 14, I think.
And, yeah.
And I liked that movie. I think Statham actually, he's such a good convincing physical presence mm-hmm. that I was willing, I bought him in a lot of ways as Parker. But at the same time, he talked about his code, and he mm-hmm. at one point did a kind of Robin Hood thing with some people who had helped him along mm-hmm. the way. And there were things about it where they just felt they had to soften up this character a lot.
They had him pretend to be a cowboy, which threw me out of the movie completely, that Parker would do that.
Yeah,
or that Jason Statham would do that.
Yeah, there were definitely things about it that didn't feel like Parker, but there were moments to it that did. And
right.
that, in
I
some
agree.
Ways, I feel like with a character as hard to film as this, that's all I'm looking for. I've actually never seen the Mel Gibson version of The Hunter Payback, but I hear it has some partisans. Some people say it's pretty good, but I actually have not seen that one.
Well, let me tell you very quickly, and I won't spoil anything if you want to see them, because it's two completely different movies. And I just rewatched the theatrical version yesterday, and I haven't rewatched the director's cut in a while, but I remember. And just very briefly, just so you'll know, and the audience if they want to, what happened was in 97, 98, Mel Gibson was filming this movie with, I forget the director, but he was just Brian Hegland, who was just Helligan. I can't remember pronouncing his name. But anyway, he is just starting out. He didn't have a lot of pull. And so they filmed it the way that Hegland, I guess, wanted to do it, which was much more like Parker. He was just a machine. He's cold. He's hard. He's not very funny. He's not very likable. Well, they did a test audience showing of the director's version, and the audience didn't like it at all because they were going to see a Mel Gibson movie. They want wacky, funny, you know, crazy.
Oh, man.
Mel Gibson back then. You know, they wanted
Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon, right.
Yeah.
So they were totally unhappy with it. Mel Gibson panicked and demanded that they change it completely. Hegland wouldn't do it, so Mel Gibson basically fired the director, brought in his hairdresser to be the director of record, and Mel Gibson redirected the final third of the movie with a different cast, even.
Wow, I didn't know this. Okay.
In the final third of the movie, the only presence of Bronson is Kellerman. What's her name? The actress... Kellerman. I can't think of her name. Anyway, she was on the phone. They took her completely out of the movie and replaced her with Kris Kristofferson as Bronson, who is in the movie as an actor. You see him doing stuff. Came up with a whole new ending that is very convoluted, and changed everything about it.
Wow.
And that's what they released. It actually got worse reviews than from the test audience than the original version did. But I'm going to say this. I like the theatrical cut better because it's a more entertaining movie, understanding that you're not getting any closer to Parker with Mel Gibson than you were really with anybody else. Now,
right.
Now you can get the director's cut on DVD, and it's worth watching, too, because it's much more like The Hunter.
Okay, but I'm going to have to check this out then.
Yeah, you got
to
watch both versions. Watch the theatrical version. And by the way, the director's cut is like 20 minutes shorter because they added like a whole final act to it. Yeah, so it's really amazing. They also, in the theatrical cut, they did sort of a like a blue tone to the whole movie, because it's kind of a timeless movie the way they filmed it. It's like it was filmed in 97, 98 for 99 release, and yet it has rotary phones, you know. It has a lot of stuff that's kind of out of time. And they put a blue tint to the whole movie that makes it almost black and white. The director's cut.
Oh, interesting.
The director's cut doesn't have that. So,
well, and that was something interesting about watching The Grifters on the big screen for the first time at this film festival, because he did the screenplay for it. And being reminded that he and Stephen Frears decided not to make it a period piece, but it actually was set in 1989 when they were shooting, 1990. But it feels timeless because that's just how Jim Thompson's characters are.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Okay, I will have to check out Payback then.
Yeah, I fully understand that the director's cut is closer to The Hunter, but yet what they came up with, as goofy as it is for the theatrical cut, the Mel Gibson cut, it's just entertaining. It's good. Mm-hmm. So I'll say one other thing about it. I feel like Gibson does, he's still kind of Mel Gibson, but he does about as close to the book Parker as really I've ever seen. I mean,
interesting. Okay.
In some ways, Lee Marvin is more Parker. I don't think Statham is very Parker. But in some ways, Mel Gibson, there are things he does in it that are more Parker. So, yeah, I recommend that you check it out. And I got to do a show just on that movie at some point. So, Levi, what else, if anything, do you need folks to know? What have you got in the works coming up? What are you doing, and anything else?
Nothing specific that going on coming up that would, I think, interest folks tied to Westlake from me or us. I would just say, for those people who didn't know, we published the last four Parker books in late summer, so now we've got all 24 available pretty much anywhere you go. Any bookstore can get them. And then to put in a plug for Hard Case Crime, they just announced they're going to be doing four Westlake books, four older ones, over the next year or so. I don't actually know what all they're doing except for the first one, which is Help, I Am Being Held Prisoner. It comes out in February. It's a comedy, a standalone comedy, ton of fun. It's about a guy who finds a way to break out of prison so he can rob a bank and then get back into prison and have an alibi. I just actually watched this Soderbergh film, Logan Lucky, which involves Daniel Craig and Adam Driver breaking out of prison to pull a heist and getting back into prison so that their alibi is secure. And Soderbergh, I know, is a Westlake fan, and the screenwriter, whose name I'm going to forget, it was a first-timer, a woman, Rebecca Blunt, maybe? Anyway, I wouldn't be surprised to find out she was a Westlake fan too, because obviously some kind of tropes are common to heist movies regardless. Obviously you're going to have problems develop, you're going to have errors, but the tone of comedy, and specifically in that movie, the way that the post-heist investigation resolves felt like something Westlake would have really appreciated. I will leave it at that for people who haven't seen that movie. But if you were into Westlake and heist stuff, it's a ton of fun. And it reminded me of Help, I'm Being Held Prisoner, because the whole point there is who would break out of jail only to break back in?
Right.
a Westlake character would.
Bruce Sibley actually was just earlier today recommending Logan Lucky to me. I knew nothing about that movie, and the title doesn't tell you a whole lot. So now I have definitely got it written down. I'm going to check it out ASAP. So I appreciate that. All right, man. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. This was a ton of fun, and it's awesome to finally get to talk to you and talk about the cool stuff that we both love and that you've gotten to do some professional work, so much professional work on. And again, if nothing else, you have my undying gratitude for getting those books out and back into print again after so long, after me just pulling my hair out trying to get them all. So thank you so much.
I'm glad to hear it. It's rare that you get to repay an author or any kind of creative artist whose work has brought you so much. Right. And I have been lucky enough that I've gotten to do that in a number of different ways with Donald Westlake and his family. And I'm really grateful to have had the chance to do it.
And dang it, now I guess I'm going to have to do some kind of a Roger Zelazny nonfiction thing. I guess I'm going to have to.
That would be awesome.
Oh, boy. I'll talk to your boss about it when the time comes. All right, man. Thank you so much. I'll let you run along. The Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week, and we'll see you guys down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.